anyways, it's time to start. So, boker tov, everybody. Welcome to what will be, please God, our last session in Perkei Avot for this year. Please God, we'll resume April the 9th, I think it is, 2021. Pesach is very early next year. Pesach is in March. Pesach begins in March. But anyways, and being today, September 11th, 19 years since the horrific attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and the whole terror attacks. And we know that the calendar repeats itself every 19 years. The Hebrew and English calendar repeats itself every 19 years. I think we're a day off. Sometimes it's a day off. And that was, if I remember correctly, it was on a Tuesday that it happened, a Tuesday morning, and Rosh Hashanah was the following Tuesday. So we're like a day off. We're Friday, Rosh Hashanah is the next day, but the Hebrew and English day to the week before Rosh Hashanah. So I want to dedicate this year to the memory of the close to 3,000 people who were killed in the attacks on September 11th. And please God, we should see terrorism come to an end. There's, you know, we can look at the bright side or the not bright side. Baruch Hashem, Israel and UAE are signing a peace treaty this week, and please God, other countries will follow, and you know, whatever. Well, let's hope that should be peace, health and peace. Those are the two main things we need, especially this upcoming year. Okay, so I think today we have a couple of fascinating topics to discuss. We leave the best for last. Okay, so we're in Perek Gimel, Mishnah Yudalit, 314, at least in my running, you may be a Mishnah op or two. Hu Haya Omer. So we're in the middle of Rabbi Akiva. Last week we ended off by talking how you protect things, right? You have to be quiet. If you want to be smart, Siag L'chach Mashtika, shut up if you want to be smart and just listen to other people. Keep your mouth shut. Sometimes some people have to talk. If you teach, you have to talk. But otherwise, it's better to listen to the shir than to give the shir. What can I say? Anyway, that's how we ended. So Rabbi Akiva continues. Hu Haya Omer. Chaviv Adam Shenivra B'Tselem. Beloved is man. He's created B'Tselem. He's created the image of God. That's an amazing thing. And that's, of course, that's what makes us human beings. The difference, the qualitative difference between animals and humans is that humans are created in the image of God and animals are not. As a matter of fact, that's how, this is not the time for discussion, but just to mention, that's how some people explain the issue with the age of the universe and, you know, how long humans have been around, that the Neanderthals, let's say, were human-like, but they didn't have the image of God. And if you look in the Pesukim, it actually works. Man was created then. Ha-Adam, there's Adam and Ha-Adam and Ha-Adam. The man is the man created with the image of God. God breathed the image, his image into Adam, whatever that means exactly. But it's wonderful. Now we're creating the image of God. It means we have to copy God. The Yud Gimel Midot that Rabbi Liebtag will talk about on Saturday night is our way to imitate God. The same way God is merciful, we're merciful. God is kind, we to be kind. We're supposed to be godly. I mentioned Rabbi Soloveitchik said that's the main, if you want to sum of Judaism, so there's Hillel's, you know, description, what's hateful to you, don't do to others, or Rabbi Akiva, love your neighbor as yourself. But Rav Soloveitchik summed up Judaism is that we have to imitate God. That's the main function of the Jew, is to imitate God. And we mentioned that's why the Torah begins with creation. That man is to be a creator. And whatever our talents are, we have to create. And that's why the first mitzvah is to create other human beings, to have children. So it's a wonderful gift. Man is beloved. The fact that God created us in the image. In Master, he's sharing of himself, in so to speak, with God. Now the mission gives a funny idea. Chaviva Yetera. Extra love, shenodatlo shenivra b'tzom, that we know we're created in the image of God. In other words, it's like a funny thing. God could have created us as an image without telling us. Another fact, and the verse that they quote, shenemar b'tzelem olhim asat adam, that man is created in the image of God, is not from in Bereishit, Parsha Bereishit, where it happened. It's in Parsha Noach. It says in Bereishit that God created us in his image, but that's before he created Adam. Adam was unaware that he was being created in God's image. I don't exactly know the difference, but the Rabbi Akiva stresses the point. It's one thing, you can have a gift and not know of the gift. So God created us his image, that's great. In other words, we can, and in a certain sense, that's maybe a lot of the world. They don't appreciate or recognize God or believe in God, whatever, but they act in God-like ways. They are God's partners, even without realizing that they're created. But it's an extra special love of God that he notified us. Chiva yeterah shenodat lo shenifra b'tzelem, shenamar b'tzelem Elohim, Asad Haddam, God created us. Okay, so what I want to focus on now is the unbelievable long comment of the Tiferet Yisrael. We've mentioned him almost every week. I mention him, the Tiferet Yisrael Lifshitz, born in the late 18th century, died around 1860 or so, and wrote what's considered, I don't know, the third most important commentary on the Mishnah, whatever. It's later, there's the Bartanura, the Tosfot Yontif of Yontif Lippmann Heller from Prague in the 16th century. Then the Tiferet Yisrael, who takes up a lot of space in Baum. So he has a fascinating, he often has a fascinating comments, which is why I left to quote him. So he'll start, I don't know where exactly to start the piece, but maybe I'll start where he starts. He starts with, he's very bothered. I guess maybe by way of introduction, I'll say a number of years ago, there was a little bit of a controversy when Mark Shapiro published the letters of the Sri Deish in the Torah Mother Journal. Without getting into it, Torah Mother Journal was sort of out of YU, Yeshiva University. J.J. Schechter was the editor, Rabbi Dr. J.J. Schechter is the senior scholar at YU, a great leader, teacher. And he was the editor of the Torah Mother Journal. It was the intellectual, sophisticated, sort of academic Jewish studies, whatever. So Mark Shapiro, who did his PhD, he teaches for us all the time, wonderful, you know, leads our trip. So he published, I guess, private letters of the Sri Deish, Rav Yaakov Yechiel Weinberg. And in those letters, it turned out the Sri Deish's best friend was Shmuel Atlas. Now, Shmuel Atlas is a Reform rabbi. This is very unusual. The Sri Deish is a gadol b'tor in the first rank. Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Avadya Yosef, like, you talk about the greatest, greatest, greatest Torah scholars of the 20th century, the Sri Deish makes the list. And his best friend was a Reform rabbi. He was a very knowledgeable Reform rabbi. And he would often say that he could talk to him about things that he couldn't talk to his colleagues about. And one of the things that he had difficulty talking to his colleagues about, in other words, other Gadol Yisrael, other quote-unquote Orthodox, you know, a traditional Gadol B'Torah, was that the Jewish position vis-a-vis non-Jews, that you find in Chazal occasionally, you find both, okay? You'll find statements in Chazal that denigrate non-Jews, that, you know, or even the halacha that in theory you don't save the life of a non-Jew on Shabbat. In practice we do, but in theory not. So he said he struggled with these issues. Okay, that's good. Everybody struggles. It created a whole controversy. Should he publish these letters? Is it wonderful to see? Is it not? That's not our topic now. Why do I mention that? So that's how the Tiferet Yisrael begins. He says he's very troubled. You find within Chazal there's a statement that Jews are considered Adam, and Umat HaOlam, the nations of the world, are not considered Adam. And he says, that's insane. How can that be? How can the rabbi say such a thing? He says, first of all, it's not even true, because there are, or you have other rabbinic statements that say the exact opposite. And that for the pious of the world can have a share in the world to come, that there are many, many statements praising rabbis. So you could argue these are, my uncle once said that you find this about every issue almost. That you find statements very extolling non-Jews, and there's others not, degrading, if you want to use that word. It often depended on where you lived and who you lived and what your life experience is. A person who went through the Holocaust has a very different attitude towards non-Jews than somebody like me who grew up in wonderful Canada and, you know, everything's so wonderful, you know. But if you went through the Holocaust, you're going to think much differently of non-Jews for very good reasons. So, and Mayank said, you find over a long tradition, so you have this attitude, that attitude. We don't have to reconcile that. Our earlier classes spoke very often. Our tradition is multifaceted, and not everything agrees with everything. That's a misconception sometimes people have, that you have to solve every contradiction. You can't even solve all the contradictions within the Rambam. The Rambam himself contradicts himself. That's okay. You don't have to solve, for sure, the Rambam and other people, but even within people, from Soloveitchik, everybody, all great people are contradictory. That's the nature of being. That's the nature of human beings. That's the nature of Torah. We say it every morning, 365 days a year. Two verses of the Torah that contradict each other. We have to find the Katuv Ashlishi, Sheikh Ribe name. We have to resolve the contradiction, but the contradictions are there. You could say that, but he's very troubled. And as he he goes through, he discusses that not only are, first of all, we have other statements, but it's, I don't need other statements. I have my seichel. That's the word he uses. Anybody who has any seichel knows that they're wonderful non-Jewish people. What do they not at them? And then he goes on, and this is what is quite amazing. I don't know if any of you have heard this this comment before he made. So he said that there are many non-Jews who are, of course, greater than Jews. And then he starts talking about the Chasidei Umat HaOlam, these great, the great pious people of the world. Kama miChasideihem. The most pious, the most great of the non-Jews, who A, might believe in God, although that's not necessarily, well, we'll see if that's a condition, and they do amazing things. And then he mentions four people. He mentions Edward Jenner, the inventor of the smallpox vaccine. And then he mentions Jenner. He mentions Gutenberg, the inventor of the printing press. He mentions Sir Francis Drake. We'll come back to him. That the rumor was, although the historians say it isn't true. I don't know what word he has in language. They put some word, a carpal. I don't know. But I think they say he brought the potato to Europe. What he writes, he saved hundreds of thousands of people from hunger. And Reuchlin, he was the non-Jew who prevented the burning of the Jewish books in 1509. So he mentioned these four non-Jews. These are the greatest of people, much greater. They did much greater benefit to humanity than, you know, any Jew, almost, maybe with the exception of, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu or somebody. He says, these are Hasidei Olam. Now, first of all, just this comment, we're talking mid-19th century, early 19th century, where you have, a classical Ashkenazi, whatever, Gadol B'Torah, writing that, of course, why is he writing on this mission? Because, of course, non-Jews are also created in the image of God. The image of God, it's Chaviv Adam, right? Man was created. Noach wasn't Jewish. When we say B'Tzelem Elohim Barat Adam, we're talking about non-Jews. So he says, so his question is, he doesn't understand how they're going to say anything negative about non-Jews. How can they do that? And they're so great. So I just want to very briefly touch about, and I don't know if I'll share my screen, whatever, but anybody want to guess? And you can, I think you can unmute yourself or you can write it in. Anybody want to guess how many people died of smallpox? Anybody have any idea? Now, I first heard this, I remember Eddie Reichman at one of our medical ethics conference mentioned this, and it's documented. Anybody want to write it in the chat? Nobody wants to guess? Let's say in the 20th century. How many people in the 20th century, that's not so long ago, died of smallpox? Guess. Don't worry. No, nobody wants to guess? Okay. So 300 million people. 300 million people died of smallpox in the 20th century alone. You don't believe me? Let me just share my screen for 1 minute because I don't believe me either. Right? I wouldn't believe it either. But that's apparently, let me just find here. So if you see here smallpox, eradicating, so this is from the BBC, okay, you'll say it's whatever. An estimated 300 million people died from smallpox in the 20th century alone. This virulent disease, which kills a third of those who infects, is known to have coexisted with human beings for thousands of years. So this is like, so you begin to understand when the Tiferet Yisrael says he's the Chasidei Umat Olam, what Edward Jenner, he wasn't the first one to develop, excuse me, he was the one who really developed, who put in, I think, he was the first one to put in a live vaccine, the live disease, into a nine-year-old, I think, I don't know if it was his own kid or somebody he knew, his neighbor's kid, and that really began the eradication of smallpox. I think it would kill, millions and millions of people died of smallpox. Gutenberg, of course, is a totally different invention, but I don't have to tell you the printing press changed. It's like the internet. I would say even greater. The print, how much we've all seen it in our times, how the internet has revolutionized. The fact that I'm giving this class on Zoom, the fact that there's a lockdown is only because of Zoom. I don't mean Zoom, I mean of technology. In other words, and the Spanish flu 100 years ago, they couldn't lock down because nobody could live. Today, I don't know how to phrase it. It's not a nice thing to say in a sense, but all the decision makers, they can do all their work on Zoom. most white-collar workers, it doesn't affect the people the site. So we locked down and people walked around in the Spanish flu and they, whatever, 50 million people died. You know, that's one type of thing. But so the internet has totally revolutionized. We all know that. The printing press did even more. And just like the printing press, there was a lot of rabbinic opposition. Not anymore, because you know, what kind of idiot is against? Like, you can't be against the internet. It's like, you can't live without it. It came out. But when the printing press started, there were many rabbinic. The Maharal's brother was the most like famous one. The Maharal of Prague, his brother was also a great, great Torah scholar. Was very much opposed to the printing press. Says this is a terrible thing. Jews won't need rabbis anymore. Sound familiar? Who needs a rabbi? You can just look it up in a book, you know, and he was very afraid this would be the end of Ashkenazic Jewry, fascinatingly enough, living in Prague, because the Sephardic world was basically dominant. I mean, maybe this, we're talking, the Maharal dies in 1609, I believe, but, you know, when in the Spanish expulsion in 1492, so apparently 90% of world Jewry lived in Spain, 90% of world Jewry. And the Sephardim were a much greater number. And there was fear that everybody's going to start reading these books, the Sephardic books. They're going to read Rav Yosef Karo, and they're going to see, whoa, Sephardim eat kitniyot on Pesach. Why can't we eat kitniyot on Pesach? And he was very much afraid that bringing in books from Sephardim, it's like just a fascinating thing. But I don't have to tell you how the printing press revolutionized everything we do. And I mean, it's hard to imagine, but owning a book, you know, 500 years ago, 600 years ago was not an easy thing to do. You had to be very, very wealthy. On our trip to Germany with Mark Shapiro, we go to Mainz where Gutenberg invented, invented the printing press. And we see the Bible, of course, was the first book that was ever printed. You see the factory in Mainz. So the Tiferet Yisrael is talking about the Chassidi Omat Olam, these amazing, amazing people. Now, what's fascinating about this, he doesn't say anything about their character. Sir Francis Drake, who's the other person he mentions, has a very, I would say, you know, checkered history. You can read up about it, whatever. And the point being that the Tiferet Yisrael doesn't comment if they were righteous or pious, how much charity they gave, or did they talk Lashon Hara. In other words, the fact that they invented the printing press, he could have been a manuval. I'm not saying he was, but in other words, he doesn't, his reason that they're great people because they did something great. That's divorced from one's character. This is a fascinating idea. And you think about it in Jews, do we fully accept that? What's more important, what you accomplish or who you are? Because sometimes what you accomplish, you don't control in a sense. But on the other hand, Rav Soloveitchik said it, and it's a little bit, I'm not sure if this is mainstream Jewish thought, because you have here and there. But in the Machzor of Rav Soloveitchik, when he talks on Yisker, on Yom Kippur, so we mention the people who passed away. That's what Yisker is all about. And the original Yisker, of course, was only on Yom Kippur. It's a problem to say Yisker on Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot. You're really not allowed to. And I think the Sephardim don't, because Yontif is a happy time. Yisker brings out sad emotions, and you're not allowed to. We end Shiva. We, in the middle of the Shiva, we end when it's Yontif. So why are we mentioning dead and our parents? It's totally incongruous with Yontif. No, the Minhag developed for a variety of reasons, which maybe we can talk about in our Shir on Sukkot, I don't know. But the Minhag comes from Yom Kippur. Really, the Minhag is the Yisker on Yom Kippur, and then it got expanded to the Shalosh Regalim. But in Yisker, so Rav Soloveitchik said that the dead also need a kapara. So this is quite I'm not quite sure everybody would agree with that. Why did the dead need atonement? Because we know that what you do, the actions continue for many years. You can put in something in motion. You invented the Rav Meir Shapiro, right? They're talking about Rav Meir Shapiro when they finished up Daf Yomi this past January. So what did it say? Everybody learns Daf Yomi brings a merit to Rav Meir Shapiro because he put something in motion. He doesn't have to be alive. Rashi, every time you learn Rashi. So that's the question. How much credit do they get, or, you know, for something that they're not alive anymore. They're not doing anything. So, but that's what the Rav Soloveitchik said, that your actions, your impact lives on after you die. So they need an atonement. Maybe some of the things they did and some of the things they said are still hurting people many years later. So we even pray for the dead. So in a certain sense, that's what the Tiferet Yoh is saying. Doesn't it matters who the person is, but maybe not as much as what they do. So you can be, if you accomplish great things, you get your prize to the world regardless of who you are. That's maybe sounds a little bit radical, but that it does clearly appear to say what the Tiferet Yisrael is saying. Now, he calls Reuchlin a chassid. He was Moser Nefesh, or just let me pull on my screen for 1 minute again. If I can find it. No, that's not where I want it. Stop sharing. Hold on. Okay, I don't know where it is. Okay, forget it. I was going to point out, but in 1509, how he prevented the burning of Jewish books. So here I understand why we call this person a pious person. He did something not only for benefit humanity, he did something for the benefit of the world. But I just find this Tiferet Yisrael, and that he was killed for it. In the end, he paid by his life. So the Tiferet Yisrael said, you have these wonderful non-Jews, whether they're wonderful in their character and their willingness to help the Jewish people, all the pious of the world and the Holocaust, all those risks, there are all the people, the thousands and thousands of people who risked their life, many of whom were killed, got caught. So these are pious people. That's one type of a pious person. But then there's the other type of a pious person, somebody who benefits humanity. I mentioned, I think last week, to me, if I can say this, just to extend on Tiferet Yisrael, I think Bill Gates falls into both categories. Bill Gates is really amazing. He's giving away him and Warren Buffett, they're giving away 99% of their wealth. I mean, Bill Gates is the one who's paying for the manufacture of many vaccines now before they're approved. So when they do get approved, then we'll have them for use. I mean, I'm sure people know his foundation and what he does in Africa and Asia, all over the world. And he's amazing. He's amazing. And what he did, Microsoft changed the world. The founder of Apple didn't have those same qualities. He didn't give away 99% of his wealth. And Warren Buffett is a little bit different, but it's the same idea. So here you have somebody who did amazing contributions to the betterment of the world. That's what we're put on earth for. That's God created us, B'Tselem Elohim. That's exactly what the Mishnah is saying. That's what Rabbi Akiva was saying. We're created B'Tselem Elohim to be like God. But what did God do? God created. God made a better world. So that's what man has to do. So man has to make a better world. So that's what you can be a disgusting person. You can be an awful person, be a wonderful doctor, make some great inventions. Okay, so you're not a good person, but at least you contributed in many, many ways to the betterment of the world. That's wonderful. Wonderful. If you can combine the two, so that's even more amazing. That you combine the two with character, so that's amazing. That's, I just wanted to point out the Tiferet Yisrael. Now, to continue, so he's bothered. So how do you have these these statements that non-Jews are not so good? So I mentioned already, it could be, listen, it went through the Holocaust, he lived through the Bar Kokhba revolt, whatever. By the way, it's amazing, this is Rabbi Akiva. This Rabbi Akiva was killed by the Romans, who's making this statement. Rabbi Akiva, who we see with it's Rabbi Akiva who said, love your neighbors yourself. This is the same Rabbi Akiva who's teaching us on the value of human beings and the value of human life. He knows what it's like to suffer and to see martyrdom, etc. But what did the Virgil says? He says here, now this is also, I find, a fascinating concept. He says that, non-Jews and Jews, each one has an advantage over the other. He says, the Jewish people, you don't have to like this, you don't have to agree with it, but I'll tell you what he says. He says, Jews had the Torah revealed to them, revelation. The basis of our life is revelation at Sinai. The Rambam says a Jew who doesn't believe in that loses their share in the world to come. The whole basis of our religion is our traditions emanate from Sinai. Pirkei Avot began. Moshe Kibel Torah Misinai Masara LeYoshua. That's where we begin. Even the ethical teachings and not just the wisdom of the nations. That's what the Bartanur explains. Yeah, everybody has wisdom. Everybody has ethics. But our ethics are from Sinai. They're just not human ethics. So he says, Jewish people have revelation. On the other hand, non-Jews discover things on their own. That's what he says. He says, they're luckier. They're greater. Because if somebody gives you the whole curriculum, gives you all the questions on the test, right? Like the Gemara says, you know, when we meet our in Shemaim at 120, God, there will be six questions God will ask us. So we have the questions in advance. It's easy. I mean, it's not so easy to do well, because even when we have the questions, to be honest, in business, the first question, not so easy if you know God's going to ask you. Kavati itim Torah. Did you set aside time for Torah? But still, we know the questions. It's a lot easier than if you don't know what's coming. So he said the non-Jews are amazing, because so many of them figured out wonderful ethical principles on their own. I mean, Rav Sadia Gaon was the sort of the first one to develop the idea that we don't need the revelation for half the Torah. We don't need the Torah to tell us not to steal. It's a debate in philosophy. Not all accept that. He says some people will argue murder is only wrong because of divine revelation. Well, why should, whatever. But that's a philosophical discussion. But Rav Sadia Gaon in the 10th century, developed the theme of that the mitzvot sichliot from the seichel, which is exactly what he learns. Mitzvot sichliot. We don't need revelation for that. We don't need the Torah. So the non-Jews have a greater reward and a greater concept, because they manage, many of them, to be ethical people and wonderful people without the advantage of God telling them what they have to do. Nope. What's the Jewish advantage? The Jewish advantage, we have revelation. It says it's very nice. But you know what? Many non-Jews haven't figured out what to do. Many of the non-Jewish world is backwards. I don't even want to say what he says, because it's not nice. But I always like to be intellectually honest. It's the 1800s. He says, Kirov Toshavei Africa, like the majority of the residents in Africa. In other words, they're backwards. That's what he was saying. Whatever. I'm just quoting him. I don't think Argam in America, Yeshu even in America, remember he's living in the early 1800s. I don't know exactly when he wrote this, but I'm assuming in the early 1800s. It says, even in America, there are many people who walk in the darkness. And this is kind of an interesting idea. In other words, it's great to discover revelation on, discover the Torah on our own, discover ethics on our own. But the fear of that is you may not discover it. So the nations have that advantage that they came to it on their own. And the Jewish people have the advantage is they know what the end game is. I don't know, you can argue on this, but I just found it a fascinating idea. To me, it reminds me a little bit about the debate discussion in the Talmud. Is it not exactly the same, but it does remind me. Is it better to do mitzvot because we have to, or to do them because we volunteer to do them because we want to do them on our own? And the Gemara originally thought, obviously, you ask your typical Jew or non-Jew on the street, what's better, to do what you have to do because you want to do it or because you have to do it? So we would say, of course, the volunteer is better. That's much better. You don't. If I have to daven, okay. Well, I don't want to daven. I have to do it. What can I do? Or I have to follow the law. I have to pay my taxes. I don't want to pay my taxes, but I have to do it. Give charity. That's on my own. That's much greater, right? So everybody says that. And then the Gemara says, no, it's better. Gadol hametzuva vosa. One who is commanded is on a higher level. Different explanations why. Tosfot explains because we have a natural, human beings have a natural inclination not to like to be ordered around. We like to do what we want. You tell me to do X, I'm going to do Y, just because you told me to do X. So once it becomes an obligation to do something, it's harder. The Yetzer Hara, the desire to not do it, is greater. So that gives me a greater reward. And we also know that as great as a volunteer is, no organization can survive on volunteers. So no, a volunteer, he'll come. How many volunteers are going to come in every day between 9 and 5, let's say, even like they do an office job? You can't ask a volunteer to do that. It's snowing. It's a 10-inch snowstorm. They can't come. But a worker has to come. We expect more. A volunteer, we think they're wonderful even when they take off. And they are. But so that's why the Talmud sort of, it's a little bit counterintuitive. a little bit counterintuitive, but the Talmud comes to the conclusion that doing a mitzvah when you're not obligated is not quite as great. In other words, to put it in very practical terms with Rosh Hashanah, we'll discuss it maybe a little bit, not too much next week when I give my class on Rosh Hashanah on Thursday night. Women, of course, are not obligated in shofar. That's one of the classical few mitzvot that women are actually, there's no obligation for a woman to hear shofar. Woman has to daven. We were talking before the class. Woman has to daven just like a man. The obligation for prayer is equal to men and women. But shofar, no, mitzvot aseisha is man grama, but it's not an exception. No, but we all know a 99.9% of women go to the shofar. And we even allow a man to go to a woman's house. An old woman can't go to shul. She's home alone. So it's a great mitzvah that the man goes to her house at after shul at 1:30 in the afternoon, and he blows shofar, and he makes a bracha. He makes a shir kitshanu mitzvah b'tzivanu, right? The Ashkenazic minag, we do say that bracha, even if we're not obligated for the woman. So maybe the women are greater, because they don't have to hear shofar. So if you would have held the original thought of the Talmud, that a volunteer is greater, so it would actually turn out a woman who hears the shofar would be greater than the man who hears the shofar, because she doesn't have to do it. But that's not the end, because obviously when you have to do something, there's more of a push. And I guess on a certain level, it's saying, do your obligations first, and then worrying about volunteering. But anyways, this is the Tiferet Yisrael here on this notion that man is created in the image of God. So the way he says it, that's how he sort of goes. On the one hand, yes, you have non-Jews who are quote-unquote are act like animals. Of course, some say you have Jews who act like animals too. I mean, it's not a, that's why, but it's interesting for a great rabbi to write this, I think, in the 9th century is quite a fascinating idea. And even his notion that the non-Jews who are ethical are in a certain sense on a higher level than Jews because they discovered it without revelation. I don't know that today, I don't know how well that rings. And today, I don't know how many of us keep Judaism because of revelation. We were brought up that way, and we were taught to believe in revelation. I don't know, it's a whole different thing, but it's to me, it's a fascinating comment. Okay, so that's the first line in the Mishnah. We all, Tzelem Elohim bara ta adam, man, Jew and non-Jew, will soon create with Tzelem Elohim. Okay, Chaviv in Yisrael, now we're going to move to something which is special among Jews. Shenikru banim lemakom. We're called the children of God. Chiba yeteira, the same idea, an extra thing that God told us were his children, right? All of humanity are the children of God. But there's a special, b'nei b'chori Yisrael, the Jewish people are the eldest born of God, so to speak, even though we're not biologically. In other words, our nation came later, but qualitatively or whatever, in the relationship, God has a special relationship. Shenemar banim atem l'shem alokechem. That was the pasuk we read about 3 weeks ago. In Parshat Re'eh, Banim Atem L'Hashem Elokechem, you are children to God, Lo Tit Ko Tadu. So it's a funny thing, Lo Tit Ko Tadu V'Lo Tosim Korcha Bein Enechem L'Meit. So the simple explanation of that verse, Lo Tit Ko Tadu V'Lo Tosim Korcha, a kerach, a hole, can't rip your body when somebody dies. We're the children of God, and God, we're created in the image of God, and death is part of life, and while we rip our clothes, you cannot rip your body. You know, ancient world people, you know, they mutilate their body on the death of somebody. So that's a Torah considers that a terrible prohibition. In a certain sense, it's denying God's creation. In other words, it's yes, we mourn, but we have to accept this as part of how God created us. We're the children of God. Lo tit ko tadu, v'lo tosim korcha bein enechem l'meit. On the other hand, the rabbis have an additional level, a beautiful idea here. Lo tit ko tadu, lo tasu agudot agudot. Do not make divisions. Do not factionalize. We violate this prohibition. I don't want to talk about it, but I don't have to tell you. Lo tasu agudot agudot. Jewish people are not allowed to factionalize. Denominations are, it's a prohibition maybe to say he's Orthodox and Reformed. They're Jewish. They're more of, I don't want to sound like a Chabadnik here, but I think they got it 100% right. They're Jews. They're more observant Jews and they're less observant Jews. Yes, they're Jews who don't accept the tenets of Orthodoxy. Okay, Beseder. But to say they're sort of michutz lamachaneh, outside of the camp of those who were at Rabbi Adler's class, I welcome come on Monday morning talking about the Rav, That's what he said. What's Yom Kippur? Kol Nidre. We start Kol Nidre. We invite sinners, every single Jew. We can be the biggest atheist in the world, the biggest oisvar, the biggest. We have to have him in Shul Yom Kippur. Every Jew is welcome. I don't care what they believe, what they do. And if they're not coming to Shul, it's our fault. We're not inviting them in. So that's Lo Tasu Agudo. We're children of God. The worst thing for a parent is when children fight. I don't have to tell you when children fight. So Banim Atam Lashem Okechem. So the rabbis say, Lo Tit Kodadu, Lo Tasu Agudo. Don't split, don't make holes in the Jewish people. There is a fascinating debate between Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda. Are we the children of God always, or only when we follow the will of God? But if we don't follow the will of God, then we're not children. That's a fascinating thing. In other words, sometimes parents, write off their children, write them out of the will. I don't know. So it sounds kind of awful to us, but maybe a child can be so terrible that they're not, I don't want to have anything to do with you. So that's I believe it's Rav Meir who says that. And Rav, we don't accept that of you. We accept like normal parents. Even if we stray and we sin and we're terrible, we're the children of God. So in other words, everybody agrees. That's what it means to be Jewish. We do have a special relationship with God. Now that special relationship, if I'll say, I had the book, I was reading it, I had it on my desk the other day. Morality in the Marketplace. I forgot by Rabbi Dr. Aaron Levine. The Sacred Tzaddik Libracha. So I don't know if I mentioned him. Anybody know who Aaron Levine was from Yeshiva University? I know nobody answers when I ask questions, but you can. He was the professor of economics, the head of the economics. Tremendous Talmid Chacham. I may mention that he was really, in many ways, the founder of the field of Jewish business ethics. And a great, wonderful person. And I had him as a professor when I was in YU and the comparative economic theory. So it was a whole class. I mean, the course was called comparative economic theory. And it was really just a class on if the halakha, if the state of Israel were to establish an economic system based on halakha, what would it look like? It was a fascinating course. It would be like a secular law course, but he's quoting Gemara's, Bava Metzia, Bava Kama, whatever, how he would set up. But in one of his later books on moral issues in the marketplace or something, or on case studies, so he has a whole introduction there. And the introduction of the book is basically how our obligation to be moral is much higher when we deal with non-Jews than with Jews. In other words, Jews, we're part of the same family. So when people are in the family, we cheat each other a little bit. We yell at each other a little bit. Well, not necessarily good. But when you do it to outsiders, it's a lot worse. And of course, there's the Chilul Hashem. And this whole point, and I think I have mentioned this, that the Gemara's example is always on Gnei Batad, on misleading somebody or things, is always by non-Jews. In other words, the Gemara would use the non-Jews. Our ethical treatment has to be higher dealing with the non-Jew. Yeah, it's because we have a special relationship with God. It's sort of ironic in a sense. Because Jews have a special relationship with God, God has chosen us for a mission. It's a responsibility. It's not it's a privilege, but it's mainly responsibility. Therefore, we have to treat those who weren't, chosen to have part of the special relationship even better. So that's point two in the Mishnah. It's wonderful we're called children of God, and God even told us so. Then the Mishnah continues, Chavim Yisrael shenatan lehem kli chamda. It's nice to be Jewish, but you should keep the Torah. You can be Jewish and not keep the Torah. That's also, it's very wonderful to be Jewish. By the way, that's a fascinating dispute as an aside, but as a halachic dispute, there's among contemporary halachic authorities debate the question of whether we should convert, let's say you should adopt a non-observant couple, should adopt a child, convert them to Judaism, and not bring up the kid observant. The kid will turn up to be, he'll be a Mechallel Shabbos, he won't keep kosher, maybe be a wonderful person. Is that good? Is it better to be, if you're going to be totally non-observant, is it better to be Jewish or non-Jewish? So that contemporary authorities debate that question. The fact, and it has halachic implications, let's say on the question of adoption. better stay a non-Jew. What do you have to be Jewish for? By the way, because a child doesn't have to accept mitzvot. That's a whole, I won't get into how Israel could solve the problem with the Russians in one generation and with the stroke of a pen based on Rav Moshe Feinstein easily, but whatever, politics, like everything. It's because a child doesn't need, everybody agrees, a child doesn't need Kabbalah or mitzvot. So you convert them before bar mitzvah, and then 18, they can say they can undo a conversion. A person who's converted, a child always has the right, but they don't have to undo the conversion. They want to be Jewish. Sure, I love being Jewish. Most Jews love being Jewish. They don't want to be observant. They remain Jewish. So that's a debate, whether it's better or not. It's a fascinating debate. And we know many Jews are very happy to be Jewish. It's wonderful to be Jewish today, but in America, it's great. Well, usually, hopefully. But the Mishnah continues, but really our mission is Torah. The Torah is a wonderful gift. It's not an obligation. Rav Moshe Feinstein always used to say, or I heard a quote in his name many times, one of the tragedies of the post-war generation, and what they said was true, but it was still a tragedy to say it. I don't know Yiddish, but it's schwer zu sein a Yid. It's hard to be Jewish. It was hard. It was hard. If you were Shomer Shabbos, you couldn't get a job. You had to go into kosher. It was very hard. But, kids growing up in America, their parents anyways are quote-unquote greeners. I don't like to use the term, but you can understand the kid whose parents speak Yiddish and he wants to be American. And the kid parents are saying how difficult it's to be Jewish. So who wants this? Of course, they're not going to be observant. You have to bring up, it's beautiful to be Jewish. It's wonderful. It's such a tremendous privilege. We can be such wonderful people with such tremendous guides and morality and ethics and teaching and pursuit of knowledge and breath, etc. So it's a wonderful thing. The Torah should, God forbid, never be a burden. Yes, of course, like everything in life. Sometimes we're not in the mood. Sometimes it's hard. Everything worthwhile is hard. We don't like to do it all the time. Of course, we don't like to always keep the Torah. It can be a nuisance at times, but it's a beautiful nuisance. We know that it's for our benefit. So that's what the Mishnah begins with, man. Humankind is created in the image of God. And that's the Tiferet Yisrael, non-Jews, Gutenberg, Drake, Reuchlin, Jenner, especially Jenner, think of now what's going on, with the person, if somebody comes with the vaccine, the Hasidim Umat Olam, wonderful people. Then we moved on to Jews, and then we say, but it's not enough to be Jewish. We have a beautiful gift from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay, Shenemar ki lekachtov nateti lechem Torah tiyaltasovu. We sing it every week when we used to go to shul or whatever. And even now, most shuls, they don't sing as much, at least not indoors. But ki lekachtov nateti lechem, often they don't sing that. It depends on the chasam. They started Eitz Chaim mi, ki lekachtov, whatever. God gave us a wonderful gift. Okay, the next Mishnah, which, we're going to end on a tough philosophical note. Okay, hakot safui, Mishnah tefa varshut nituna. Wow. Everything is known, but permission is given. With tova olam nidon, and the world is judged good. Okay, the Mishnah raises the problem of God's foreknowledge. God knows everything, but man has free choice. The classical question of Jewish theology. I guess the two main questions of Jewish theology are Tzadik V'Ra, why the righteous have to suffer, the Odyssey, God, and this problem of how can it be that God is all-knowing and we have free choice? So it's very fascinating. That's what it says, hakot safui, everything is sort of revealed, the harashut netuna, and permission is given. In other words, God knows everything, and permission is given for us to free choice. So the Bar Tanura actually avoids the problem. He says it doesn't mean, hakot safui doesn't mean God knows what we will do, it means God knows what we did. And there was, even Bechet Vechedarim, God knows what we do in private. He doesn't say it directly, but he implies that God does not know God necessarily what we will do. Is that what it means? You get free choice, right? In the Kabbalah, God had in order for mitzvah to make any sense, we don't have any free choice, throw away the whole Torah. There's no, Torah doesn't make any sense. If it's not up to us, then you can't have a right or wrong. It's just we do what we do. So the Bar Tanura says, "Koma shadam oseh b'ched b'chadarim galui lefanav." Everything that God we do, even in private, God knows. And to prove to you that he wasn't just also including the notion that God also knows everything, because later on he quotes Upeir Shacher. There's a second explanation. here, just let me find it. The Rambam Peirush, he quotes the Rambam. The Rambam explains it to mean that God knows what we will do. In other words, I'm not explaining that. I explain that God knows everything we've done. We can do what we want to do, but don't think what you do, you're going to escape from God. God will know what you do. But he can't know what we're going to do because then we don't have any free choice. The Rambam disagrees. We'll get to that. This is why heavy stuff in 10 minutes. We'll try to discuss one of the most difficult issues, but just to raise it. So first of all, what the Bartanur says, what I just said, maybe some of you would consider heresy, that God doesn't know what we will do. Okay, maybe some, the Rambam would consider it heresy. Rambam considered a lot of things heresy. People consider the Rambam had to be heretic. You know, like we said, Jewish people, it's lively. You know, debate. We're not monolithic. That's not how we started. Variety of views. You know, kishem shaparts of fame. Talking about the same way our faces are different. Our views are different. That's how God created us. But basically, if the Bartanur doesn't develop it, but the Rabbag, and I'm no expert on the Rabbag, Gershonides. He's the Jewish philosopher. He has a crater name for him on the moon. He was an astronomer, one of the great gedolim of the medieval, you know, Jewish period, great philosopher. And he believed that basically, you know, the question they always ask kids, you know, can God create a stone he can't lift? You know, like, well, if you say he can create a stone he can't lift, then he's not all-powerful because he can't lift the stone. And if he can't create it, he's not all-powerful because he can't create it, right? So the philosophers say, I mean, it's not a contradiction, not a problem. God can only do what he can do. God made rules. You can't make a triangle that's not 180 degrees. It's not a triangle. I mean, can I make a triangle of 360 degrees? No, you can't, because whether you're God or not God. So the Rabbag basically, and Rabbi Eisen, other people are much more expertise on this, but his basic view is that God's knowledge is not absolute when it comes to man's free choice. Now, the truth of the matter is, I came across this. No, the Rabbag is well known. I mean, in you know, people who study this. What's less known is that view today is sort of, you know, the Rambam rules. The view of the Rambam is the dominant view that both are true. We'll get to that in a moment. There's no contradiction. God has 100% knowledge, foreknowledge of everything we're going to do, and we have 100% free choice. That's the dominant view today. That's the view everybody seems to be taught. But so a number of years ago, I was reading the book Faith and Fossils by Nathan Avi-Ezer. I think one of the people, I think he's at Berlin University, he's from England, I believe, originally. He did a physicist. He was, you know, in the whole genre of science and creation and science and Judaism, reconciling science and Judaism. A lot of the scientists who are learned, you know, deal with this issue. So I was reading his book, and I came across, he was talking about how God can't know things that he can't know. Just like we can't predict the weather in 3 weeks from now. In other words, God can't know, and that's not that doesn't limit God in any way, because God, that's how God created the world. In other words, if you want to take it in Kabbalistic terms, God limited his ability in order to give man free choice. God had to take away his foreknowledge. So he said that's not a limitation of God. God can't know. We're going to know free choice. So I was reading and says, wow, I can't believe this. Like it's one thing the Rabbag said in the Middle Ages, but nobody says this nowadays. So I mentioned it to Mark Shapiro, who was at that time writing his book on the 13 principles of faith in the Rambam. Hopefully some of you have read it, a fascinating book. I'm sorry, I see somebody said I'm talking too quickly. Yeah, you should, you should have interrupted me to tell me. I apologize. So I mentioned to him, so he found it fascinating too, and he sort of included it in the footnote in this book. He gave me credit for it, okay, about them, that a modern day person would actually sort of have the chutzpah, if you want to use that term, to write that one of the ways we resolve this contradiction is by saying God's knowledge is not 100% complete. When God gave, and that's how Bartanur is most likely alluding to that when he says Hakol Safui just means God knows what we did. God knows everything, but he can't know what we will do because then we don't have free choice. Then there's the other extreme. We don't have total free choice. It's also a troubling theological position. Other people say, yeah, we have free choice to a certain extent, but God has a plan for the world. As long as you work within that plan, you can do what you want. But sometimes, like Paro, God took away the free choice of Paro. Whatever that means, we don't have time. If I had a little bit longer, I'd go into that question, how can Paro get punished for hardening heart? There's a lot of discussion, not for now. But I want to, but that is the other. So you have on the one level, they can't both be true. In other words, it can't be that God knows everything in the future and we have free choice. So either God's knowledge is slightly limited or our free choice is slightly limited. Those are the two sort of, we want to call them today, outlier views. The view that's most dominant is the view of the Rambam. Interesting, this is in Hilchot Teshuva. We're coming up to Rosh Hashanah and we're supposed to learn Hilchot Teshuva. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik famously said there are 10 chapters. He thought the Rambam did it on purpose, deliberately. There are 10 chapters in Hilchot Teshuva. The Rambam invented Hilchot Teshuva. He didn't invent Teshuva, but that there are laws of Teshuva, 10 chapters. The Rambam, he invented this whole system of Teshuva. And he has a discussion, Rav Soloveitchik has a whole article, we don't have time for it now, why the Rambam discusses free choice in the laws of Teshuva. You would think he would discuss it in Yesod HaTorah, in his opening book, The Foundations of Torah. But the Rambam, in the middle of Hilchot Teshuva, in the end of the fifth chapter of 10 chapters, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik said you do one chapter a day in a Aseret Yemei Teshuva, raises this question about how can it be that we have free choice, and without free choice, there's no Judaism. The whole thing's like a joke. How can we get punished or rewarded for what we do? So the Rambam writes, Dasha Teshuva Sheshelazu Arucha Me'eretz Midah. This, the answer to this is longer than the longest land, wider than the sea, it's basically, the Rambam says, it's impossible for man to know the answer. It's faith. God knows everything. There's a long ribbit here. The ribbit criticized the Rambam a little. The critic of them. I mean, he accepted the Rambam. He wrote his critical comment. The ribbit gets very upset at the Rambam. The ribbit says, you know, Rambam, don't raise a question you don't have an answer for. This is a fascinating philosophical, educational point. I'm much with the Rambam here. The Ravid says, don't raise questions you don't have answers to. What are you going to tell everybody? That's wider than the sea. Human beings can't understand it. Just avoid the issue. I can't accept that view, but that's the Ravid's attack on the Rambam. That's Ravid's not saying the Rambam's wrong. He's just saying, don't raise this issue if you don't have a good answer. But it's a matter of faith that both are true. And like I said, that's a dominant position. Tiferet Yisrael, we started with him, we'll end with him. But this I also heard from Aaron Rakefet in Israel many years. He gave a very cute example I might have mentioned before. Tiferet Yisrael said, what's the resolution of the contradiction? It makes sense theoretically, but we still don't really understand it. But we can conceptually understand it, even if we don't really know what it means. The Tiferet Yisrael said, what's the problem here? The problem is one of time, right? God can't know the future. We can't have free choice if the future is known, because we know what we did already. It's a question of timing. But God, of course, is beyond time. Hayah Hoveh V'yeh. In God, time merges into one. We still live in the, you know, Einstein world. Time might be relative, but we live within the confines of time. So, but somebody, God, who's above time, which we can't really understand that. But since God is above time, it's not at all a contradiction. Something that happened in the future has already happened. It makes no sense to us. But conceptually, that's what he says, that you can sort of, God knows everything that will be. We have total free choice. And time is not, that's only our issue. I remember Rabbi Aaron Rakefet, when I was in the Gris Kollel, gave Ron an acute exam. He was like me at the time, he was a big baseball fan. And he brought in, I think, the 1961, and maybe the Keem in baseball here will know better than I think. He brought in a recording. This is in the 1980s. He brought it before the internet. He brought in a recording of the Yankees, the first game of the World Series. I think the Yankees, I don't know who they were playing, and I think Whitey Ford was, you know, pitching. And he played it for us in class. I know the pitcher winds up, and he turned off the tape, and he says, does the batter have free choice to swing at the ball? I thought it was a cute example. Maybe you think it's whatever. In other words, he has free choice, except that it already happened. Now, I don't know if he swung at the ball or not. In other words, so that's what he was trying to put that into an example. Of course, the batter has free choice, but we know what he's going to do. but he still has free choice. So that's God is sort of watching us rewind on tape while it happens, whatever that means. Anyways, so that's this is this Mishnah. Hakol Safui v'Rishut Netuna u'Lefi u'Betuva Olam Nidon. And God judges us with favor. Like says that. So we're coming to Yom HaDin v'Tova Olam Nidon. God gives us the benefit of the doubt. Hakol Lefi Rova Masa. And everything depends on what we do. So I think we'll sort of end on that note. I'll just do a quick review and answer. I see there are a couple comments, I think, privately sent to me. But anyways, we basically had two major themes today, created in the image of God. That's Jews and non-Jews, and the little bit of the issue, you know, varying attitudes towards non-Jews, but the Divergil sort of, I think, the beautiful piece on these great people who did way more than almost every Jew in the world. Gutenberg and, you know, the inventions and Jenner, what they did to accomplish the world is amazing. That whole discussion and when the non-Jews and our relationship as children of God, and then of course the big problem of God's knowledge and our free choice. We have free choice, whatever, that's the assumption, you know, just how it works with God, that's what the Rambam is saying. You can't worry about that. That's God's problem. I don't worry about that. Okay, I'll just, and like I mentioned, this next Friday, it's Erev Rosh Hashanah, so we, even though we could theoretically go to Perkevot, so I'm going to give my, switching my class to Thursday night. I'm going to do 3 weeks, I called it the Sounds of Tishrei, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. So next week will be Shabbat and Shofar. Of course, there is no Shofar on Shabbat. We'll talk about Shofar in general and why no Shofar in Shabbat, etc. Hopefully it'll be nice. That's 8:30, the Sounds of Silence, and then continuing on Yom Kippur and Sukkot. This Saturday night is Menachem Liptag, as I mentioned, on the Yud Gimel Midot, 10:30 is an introduction to Smicha, into Slichot. Okay, so just somebody wrote, the Chief Rabbi of Israel, Paskin, in 2016, are now following eating kidney. No, I don't think that's true. I do not think that's true. There are certain Ashkenazim today who do eat kidney, and it could be in 30 years it will become acceptable. I mean, hugging can change, but right now, the traditional Ashkenazic view, I know, is not the Kidniot. Some have started the conservative movement. I've wrote an official truth. The conservative movement in Israel is a lot different than in America, but they did write an official, you know, tshuva allowing the eating of kidneyot. Okay, somebody wrote to me. Her husband went to Harvard in the same class as Bill Gates. Wow, very nice. Bill dropped out, as right everybody knows. Bill Gates is a Harvard draw. You know, I once saw somebody said explaining why, you know, the Haredi world doesn't have to go to university, why university is not important. They said Bill Gates dropped out of Harvard and look what he became. I mean, that's obviously a ridiculous argument. Even to be a Harvard dropout, it's not. Not everybody is ochad to be. It's not easy to be a Harvard dropout. It means you got to get accepted. He dropped out of Harvard. Husband did not. I'm glad he did change the whole world. My husband changed our family. Okay, that's also very important. We begin with the family, and sometimes, you know, the little things are the big things. Uba shofar gadol yitaka. We grow a big shofar. It's the little sounds. It's the little things that make all the difference. And Judaism isn't that. Yes, not everybody can be a Bill Gates, but there's one Bill Gates, but he's, what he's done is amazing. Okay. Your last example is a little like Shrug Cat physics example. I'm not sure. I missed that one. I'm sorry. My physics knowledge isn't good enough. Okay. All right. I want to thank you, everybody. I hope you enjoyed it over the course of the summer. Perkei Avot, I think, is wonderful. And please, God, I hope we can continue next April. Hopefully, we'll continue, even though we can, hopefully by then, everything will be back to pre-pandemic times. You should be healthy. You should have a wonderful year. But please, God, we can continue Perkei Avot in the next April, next spring. And hopefully see you all next week and for various classes. I want to wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom and a wonderful, healthy, good year. Okay. Thank you, everybody.